Copy. The tempered glass is about 4 times stronger than annual glass. So on the video we saw the guy who was actually standing on that glass, and the glass was able to hold his weight, but when he then took the small hammer and he hit the glass in the corner, it disappeared. So the contraction of the inner layer during manufacturing induces a comprehensive stress in the surface of the glass, balanced by the tensile stress in the body of the glass.
Yes, you.
Go ahead.
Is that Wesley it, or you have anything further on that subject?
Yes, I do. So, fully tempered 6mm thick glass must have either a minimum surface comprehension, compression of 69 megapascals, which would be roughly about 10,000 psi, or an edge compression of not less than 67 megapascals, which would be just a little bit less than 10,000 psi, would be, let's say, 9,700 psi. So for it to be considered safety glass, the surface compressive stress should exceed about 100 megapascals, which would be 1,500 psi. As a result of increased surface stress, when the broken glass breaks into the small rounded chunks, as opposed to the sharp, just shards. So this would be the criteria that were foreseen by the safety department for the tempered glass to be done. But tension applied to the glass can drive crack propagation, which one begins concentrate tension at the tip of the crack, driving crack propagation at the speed of sound through the glass. So consequently, a new glass is a fragile and breaks into irregular and sharp pieces. Anybody has any other ideas why is that weak point happening, or any experience, please say the word. And to exit.
Of the U.S. to end.
Board one time, you know, not made of wood, but made out of this plastic, which is a tempered glass. So, you know, it's got these little sticky feet on the bottom, you know, the four full corners. And one day the little sticky foot fell off. Okay, I'll put another one on. I have other things very similar to it. I put another one on. This way I'll have my cutting board back. Next day I see it fell off again. You know, it was too slippery. It needed to be roughed up a little bit, and then this new sticky foot be able to stick onto it. So I get a bright idea. Take it downstairs, and I take my drill, and I'll rough it up a little bit in that one corner, and which I did. I took it, drill bit, just roughed it up. Sure enough, the little sticky foot stayed on it really well. But, you know, it took me about 30 seconds or so of just drilling and trying to rough it up. Took the board, put it back on the counter, and about 4 or 5 hours later, you know, I'm watching TV in the living room, and I'm... It sounded like a bomb went off in the kitchen, and here's millions and millions of these... The drill motor that caused that to happen. Incredible. And back to you, Roy. WS1.
Yeah, I mean, material science is fascinating, and engineers spend a lot of time learning that the strength is not just a given. You know, when you say something is four times stronger, that's almost meaningless, unfortunately, because what's really going on is there's 20 different types of ways for things to break, and they're not all the same. So what you do to the material might improve one aspect at the cost of another. Your ductility, fatigability, all kinds of aspects. This is certainly common with most metals in general, but other materials as well experience different things. And what you're doing with either the Prince Rupert's drop or the glass that Wesley is talking about is you're introducing internal stresses that provide strength in one way, but weakness in another. And so that's why tapping the corner is the weak point. The stress, the internal stresses, rather than balancing each other and protecting the material, they allow that imperfection to propagate across the entire surface of the glass and make it fall apart. So metal science and general material science is incredibly complicated. There's no simple make something stronger. You can make something harder. When you make something harder, a lot of times you make it brittle. Diamond is very hard, but diamond is brittle. You can snap diamond because brittleness is not the same as hardness. They're opposite aspects of the same problem, but it's a lot more characteristics that also are in different materials. So, like all things, it gets complicated if you look deeper and deeper into it.
Okay, the next one, gallium. Fun with gallium. Here we have two interesting topics. One is interaction gallium and copper, and the other one is interaction of gallium and aluminum. Just a rest.
Yeah, if memory serves me, didn't we do this last week? I remember discussing it last week.
Oh, yeah. You have a better memory than I am. Okay, so one thing that we could add to it is page. Kurian came to the idea that interaction between solid copper and liquid gallium is a in the process of diffusion solidifying solidifying folders makes possible to create a paste for bonding two metals together or for soldering. Or so that would be intermetallic compound, the GuGa2, and that is right now as a product to be purchased from Korea. So that was interesting. I don't know if you know about it.
I don't know that particular one. I know that people have lately decided to try and use gallium as a thermal paste. The problem is a lot of times it's too close to aluminum material. The YouTube demonstrated the last thing you want to get your aluminum material, heat sinks, or anything, is gallium. It will disrupt the molecular structure and degrade it into a brittle, weak material. So I have heard people yelling and screaming on YouTube when they pop out a given custom-built computer, and rather than finding proper thermal paste, they find some alloy of gallium that they immediately scrape off and replace with decent thermal paste. So I'm not quite familiar with the copper gallium mixture. I'm sure under specific circumstances it's fine, but you got to be a little wary of gallium alloys because we use so much aluminum in manufacturing all kinds of things. And if that gets under its skin, it's gone.
Thank you very much for that. The third one is the recent one. Thank you, Dr. Roy, for responding. I think it's interesting for some electricians in here or people for you to interested in electric for you to say a few words about it. So we have LED light bulb, cheap LED light bulb made in China, and that one glows forever. So once you start it, you cannot switch it off. It glows forever. All we need for it is approximately 20 to 50 feet of wire looped at the end. Dr. Roy, explain more. And to explain.
Addresses this problem. It's relatively rare, thankfully. It depends upon an incredibly simply built LED bulb. Rather than, we talked either last week or a week or so earlier, that most modern LED bulbs use a pulse width modulation as a means of adjusting the dimming ability of light-emitting diodes, because if you just lower the voltage capacity, the voltage presented to the bulb, ordinarily, you're not going to get a nice decrease in light illumination. So there are circuits that rate of the pulse width modulation fed to the LEDs and allow for dimming. The bulbs that you're alluding to and that were shown in the YouTube were bare minimum. They were a bunch of LEDs in series connected to a bridge rectifier, connected to a voltage diminishing capacitor, and that's it. So that if you set up the AC so that there's a long run of neutral and hot wires next to each other, you allow for enough general capacitance in that electrical line to feed the LED. Not a great deal. You're not going to be able to read a book off of that glow. Oh, nevertheless. So it's because LEDs are highly efficient and cheap designs will allow the general current leakage of capacitive current to produce some illumination.
Yeah, I had some problem with that explanation on the video. Practically, it is disconnected from any power, but it is connected to the neutral, which is the ground wire, on the receptacle. And it was giving, we talk about a few watts. It wasn't just a very, very, very little LED. It was a quite good LED. So we talked about, say, 9 watts, 10 watts, and it was, you could switch the switch off, switch it on, and it was still working. That means, and the explanation that the gentleman made was about movement of electrons, and that actually put me out into, I was strongly in opposition to that that explanation. My question to you, Dr. Roy, is because you said that you agree to that what the gentleman said on the video. What is your opinion?
Well, although the full capacity of the cheap Chinese bulb was 9 watts, the afterglow, when you turn it off and there's a glow, is nowhere near 9 watts. I believe Electroboom was another guy who did the same subject. They kind of did it in pairs, and it was less than a milliwatt of power. But because LEDs are so damn efficient, just a matter of a milliwatt or so will give you a visible glow. Again, you're not going to light your house with that amount of power. So it is certainly reasonable that the electrical lines do have a small degree of leakage current. And so it's just a phenomenon of capacitive leakage current, and that's all. If you had a bleeding resistor to drain off the ever-so-slight leakage current, as the video showed, the light would go out. So I don't have a problem. LEDs do not light up unless there is current. And current is the motion of charged particles, usually electrons. So sort of by definition, you really can't have those things glowing unless you're going to assume that it's phosphorescent or something, which it isn't. It's a light-emitting diode. It's just operating in the high microwatt range of a very, very low current that's leaking through.
Anybody from the audience has a problem with leaked ground? That actually is a very much common problem in South America. I also worked in one house in Queens. When I actually touched the ground, the ground was actually at quite high potential. Anybody has any experience with that? I'm right here. It looks like we don't have electricians there. My explanation is a little bit different. You have one wire, which is the ground wire, and the other wire, although it's not connected, it exists in it, but it's hanging. So it's disconnected by the switch, but it's hanging there. Now you have a power wire that is hanging next to it, and acts as an antenna. And we have a 50 hertz or 60 hertz, depends where you are in, either in Europe or in the United States. Now this part of the transmission line acts as another wire. And then you have inductive coupling. So, but you also have a capacitive coupling. If you remember words of Dick, he said receivers are very forgivable. Transmitters are not. So in order to transmit, you gotta have to have a good antenna. But in order to receive, you can have any piece of wire, and for some reason, you are able to receive. How about that, Dr. Roy?
Basically.
Well, the rest of the audience doesn't have my email response to you, which is kind of basically that. That although I think when they did the YouTube and the way they showed it, where the two wires were right next to each other. So I think life is complicated, but when you have the two wires close to each other, it's less of a case of picking up inductively RF, and more of a case of it's more of a capacitive component with the wire right next to it. For the other experiments, for the Electroboom guy, yeah, part of that was probably inductive coupling and RF from local fields. So I agree with you that it's not 100% capacitive, but I think when they did the experiment with the lot of wire that was just one next to each other, like zip line, I think the overwhelming majority of the current was based on capacitive coupling as opposed to inductive. But yeah, you can make a case for a little bit of everything because, you know, again, things get complicated. We live in.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's enough for the science section for today. Let's go to the play section. Restriction.
Okay, thank you very much. Wesley, I have some puzzles. I just want to do one because it's very specific to space, and I'm pretty sure that Paul will have the answer. What was the first fruit?
And you got me on that one, Roy. WS1.
Really, I would have thought that you seem to know everything related to NASA and space and such. Anyone else out there who has any kind of idea of what might be the first fruit that happened to be eaten on the moon? Okay, I guess everyone's puzzled out for the night. It's canned peaches, apparently. They packed some canned peaches, and they ate them on the moon. So as far as history is concerned, supposedly, canned peaches was the first ever fruit to be eaten on the moon. So you can put that down in your trivia list of things to ask each other. Anyway, I want to thank everyone who participated in the first half of the segment of the Technical Net, and I'll be back a little bit later, but now is time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. Name here is Paul for the SpaceNet Report. And okay, on the canned peaches. Well, you know, I got on ham radio to learn everything. I mean, I heard people talking about the speed of light and the difference between, you know, the radio waves and, you know, interacting Doppler effect. And I said, wow, this is great. So you never stop learning. That's a good piece of trivia for you. Very well. Canned peaches. Did it say which astronaut brought it? I mean, everybody, you know, I mean, NASA stepped it up, but which one ate it? Did it, Armstrong eat it or Aldrin? Or was it a later mission?
Unfortunately, I just got that little bit of information from the website that I was looking through. They didn't have any details whatsoever. I tended to think it was kind of communal, but I could be wrong. You know, that they were sitting in the command and NASA packed it for them and they both gobbled it up. But I could be completely wrong.
Interesting. You know, it could be easily done on the moon. You do have 1/6 gravity. They don't have to worry about, you know, opening the can, having the thing float around like they do going to the moon or back to Earth. You know, with no gravity. But, I mean, they could do that too. They let things fly all the time, and they just float over to it and swallow it as it's flying through the air. You know, it could be, you know, water droplets or food or the M&Ms. It doesn't matter. Very good, Roy. Anyway, here we are talking about the what's new with these. There's one cop, and they've been under development for a rocket, and very simple name for their rocket. They're going to call it Rocket Number One, and this guy started it, Max Hall, and he's got it headquartered in Brooklyn right now. We talked about this probably 2017 or so. And he developed this rocket engine, 3D printed, of the booster as well with a 3D print. And, you know, he planned on launching his first rocket in 2024. And, I mean, he's been testing this engine on Long Island. He would take, you know, take his engine from Brooklyn and go out to Calverton. Calverton, big air place. You know, Grumman used to be out there and all. And he set up a test stand. And he was able to test his engine. And, you know, it didn't go anywhere, but he was able to, you know, test it, make sure it could fire for, you know, a certain amount of time. Did quite a bit of that. But now it turns out he doesn't want to stay in Brooklyn because he could find a better facility to build all this, the bigger stuff, especially the boosters, in California. Right now he has 20 employees. I don't know how many are going to go with him, but only 20 employees. You know, it's a small company. But he plans on hiring more people, and he's got this large building not too far from SpaceX, where Elon Musk has his building. So he's going to be one of his neighbors. I think they said a couple of blocks away. So he's going to set up a factory to 3D print engines. It's got like a copper base to it. You can see the engine. It's got some kind of copper alloy. A minimum of 700 kilograms, you know, roughly you know, a couple thousand, you know, 1,000 pounds or more to low Earth orbit once he gets this developed. There's many companies doing this small launch rocket business, and he's just one of them. But I hope he makes it. You know, he comes out of a. I think he was born in. A different country. I think he's from Germany. But, you know, he's been here for quite a long time, living in Brooklyn, and started this company. I was hoping he would start and keep it here in New York. You know, I mean, you know, we had Grumman here and all these companies that contributed on the island to the space program. But I guess, you know, in the long run, he's probably looking at the cost of living, and I guess he figures it's better out in California. Although, from what I understand, it, the cost of living went up there too. He might get a surprise when he goes to California. Anyway, that's the story on Launcher 2. Good luck to Hoyt. Let me drop it. So one of your neighbors probably is going to be leaving. So he only has 20 employees, but we'll see if he gets off the ground in 2024. So okay, another story about this guy was a billionaire when he started to develop this satellite company called OneWeb. This guy's name is Greg Weiler. Greg Weiler comes out of Boston. Made his money with Google. Well, I think he had a couple of projects, and then eventually went over to Google. They picked him up for his engineering capability, and he was going to start a company to, you know, create broadband connections using satellites, and Google was going to be behind it, and they were behind it, and eventually he teamed up with Elon Musk. His rocket program, Google felt, well, we'll build the satellites. You could launch them into space. And then time marched on, and I don't know, push came to shove. But next thing you know, Greg Weiler was out of it, and Elon Musk took over the whole operation himself. And now Elon Musk is building thousands of these broadband Skylink satellites. Now got over 1,300 in orbit. But Greg Weiler was still at it. I don't know if he's still got a part of the company or not. I know he's not an officer of it anymore. He started OneWeb. But they are launching satellites into space. They started a couple of years ago, but then they went broke. somebody else came to his rescue. I guess they brought him back to life. And now, recently, he's been launching satellites. But he's not using American rocketry to do it. He's using the Russians. Paying the Russians to launch on Soyuz rockets. And he's paying the European Space Agency. He wants to pay them to launch his satellites into space. He doesn't need as many as Elon Musk. He needs around 700. He's going to have around 700 miles in altitude into space, where Elon Musk is in the 350-mile area. So OneWeb would theoretically have a longer latency period when you know, that's the big thing with the computers. If you're going to be on broadband, and, you know, you're going to want a short latency period. But, he has I don't know how many rockets he's got off into space. He launches around 36 at a time, where Elon Musk does 60 at a time. Going to higher orbits, and he does, you know, he can use maybe half the amount of satellites that Elon Musk is doing to do the same thing. So they were almost partners at one time, and now they're competitors. So on March 23rd, there was the launch of another Starlink mission by Elon Musk out of California. But then at the same time, a couple hours later after he launched, sure enough, Elon's company that he started, OneWeb, launched a 36th satellite mission out of Baskochny, Russia. This is the new launch complex that Russia has started in way eastern Russia. I mean, it's so close to so far east that it's getting close to Alaska. So they started this complex a few years ago. This was their sixth launch. Eventually, they plan on launching other rockets and eventually manned missions out of Baskochny. They're setting it up for the new Angara rocket. And, but, you know, Russia has financial problems. They're way behind schedule in doing that, but they are still able to launch Soyuz rockets out of Baskochny. Sure enough, 36 satellites were launched on that same day, hours apart from Elon Musk. Interesting. Sky is going to get crowded. Sooner or later, I guess, we'll be able to sign up for broadband. They say you could already sign $99 a month, but I think you got to pay $400 or $500 for an antenna, which you would put on your roof. And they plan on eventually having gateways on Earth, where those gateways would, you know, actually reconnect it to our system to, like probably the internet to get you from your house to the gateway to the satellites that are flying up above 350 miles for Elon Musk, Starlink program, or 700 miles for the OneWeb. Anyway, interesting to see how, you know, two people almost were partners, now they're competitors. And, well, I think this guy might have sold out. I don't know if he's got part of that business anymore. Greg Weinl. I know he's a billionaire, so he's not hurting for any money. Any questions or comments? This is WS2M for the Space Network. We'll move on to another topic. NASA is going to be helping fund new companies that are interested in putting up their own space station. No, that's what NASA does. You know, NASA is, you know, top bar none. I mean, they developed all this stuff, you know, for decades. Since Dwight D. Eisenhower. But, you know, now as time goes on, eventually they... they got companies like SpaceX and Orbital ATK, now Northrop Grumman has bought them up, to launch commercial satellites to space to help out NASA, but in the long run to help themselves to become independent of NASA. You know, they'll launch cargo vehicles, and now they're launching our crew vehicles, and eventually they'll be able to take these vehicles that they have developed, and they'll be able to launch them to other locations, other space stations that could be privately held. But NASA wants to, you know, give them some kind of seed money or help them out, fund them to start doing that. And it looks like a couple of them are signing up. They have their own proposals. One of them in particular, I like. Vada Corporation. SNC, it's been around for a decade, probably 40 years, sending components and pieces of satellites, complete satellites, building them for different companies. Construction project now is Dream Chaser. The Dream Chaser is going to be in the beginning a cargo vehicle to go to the International Space Station. It will launch on a rocket, either the Atlas V or the brand new Vulcan rocket that's under development. And we'll launch it to the space station. Then we have to unload cargo, tremendous amount of cargo, more than what they can send up now, maybe 13,000 pounds and stuff instead of, you know, maybe 7,000 pounds, what they're doing now. And then eventually they deorbit and not burn up. It looks like a little space plane, and it will be able to land on a runway, actually any runway. Under development, they plan on testing their first flight, I think, toward the end of next year. And then they already have a contract with NASA for 6 flights to the International Space Station. But now they also have in development a space station, and they've taken on this idea of inflatable modules. They have these huge modules that they plan on inflating in space when they get up there. And there was a picture on that they had that they put out of what it would look like, and they show you space planes, which are nothing but dream chases, because that's what they're developing. But, you know, you could use any spacecraft to dock with this future space station that they're developing. Anyway, I sent it over to Dr. Roy's website. He might put it up on his site. It's, you know, you go to roy.ac2gs.com, and you'd be able to see this on his site. And it's not that easy, by the way. If you Google it, it's brand new. I tried finding other pictures, and I couldn't. All I could find was one. Anyway, that's what they're planning on doing. Hopefully, that company and some other companies get to develop their space station. Bigelow planned on doing the same thing, but they laid off all their people, I think, due to the virus. But Bigelow was located in, or it still is located in, Nevada. And they have these different sized modules that are inflatable that they plan on building their own space station. But I think that came to a grinding halt last year. But they did say they would restart up again. If they saw the need to do it. Bigelow is the one that put the Bigelow, they call it BEAM, B-E-A-M, Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, is what they call it. It's attached to the International Space Station now. It gives them around 600 extra cubic feet. They inflated it maybe about three and a half years ago. NASA planned on just leaving it attached for about 2 years, and then they were going to disconnect it and let it burn up in the atmosphere.
But the thing has proved so good, radiation resistant, terrific, solid as a rock. You see, if you touch it, it's like touching concrete. It's inflated. We brought up on, you know, in the trunk of a SpaceX Dragon vehicle. And used a robotic arm to attach it to the Tranquility node, one of the modules that are attached to the space station. They inflated it with nitrogen, and the thing has not leaked. No air leak. Very thick wall on this thing. I think they said four to eight inches thick. So they use it for storage now. You know, it's the same technology that Sierra Nevada Corporation wants to build this space station with. Anyway, that's the story on that. I hope they become successful because the International Space Station is not going to last forever. Right now, the plans are to probably, you know, they're going to stop paying money or adding more money to the space station probably by 2030. So, 2028, you know, by that time, I hope there's at least one new space station flying around besides what China has. By the time China will have this permanently manned space station up there, they plan on launching their first core module later this year. Maybe, I think it's in the summertime. And they plan on attaching maybe around 3 to 4 modules after that to eventually have a permanent 3-person crew. I mean, they have a long way to catch us. Right now we have 7 people on station. And next week, I think it's probably April 9th, they're going to launch another crew from Kazakhstan in another Soyuz rocket, and that'll bring the total up to 10 people temporarily for like a week. And then 3 that have been up there a long time, including Dr. Kate Rubens, California, born in Connecticut. She'll be flying down with 2 Russian counterparts to back to Kazakhstan. Any questions or comments? This is WS. Hey, nothing heard. Continue on. I wanted to talk last week about the Space Launch System. They ran a test, talking to Frank about it last week after the CXO. We talked about the test for the Space Launch System. On the bottom of this core stage, they have 4 RS-25 engines. RS-25 engines are identical to what Space Shuttle used to use. Space Shuttle had 3 of them, and Space Launch System that will be going to the moon and to Mars eventually has 4 of them. You know, of course, that's not how they get off the ground just with those engines. They use 2 solid pieces of rockets that will be attached to it. But once they pull away, these other rockets will continue on pushing them to orbit. So from the ground to orbit, they need to be flying for around a little over 8 minutes. So back in January, they ran this test. They took this massive core around, 250 feet high, with 4 engines on the bottom of it attached to a test stand, a vertical test stand in Stennis, Mississippi. That's where they have the big test stands, and they've been using them since the Apollo days. So they lit it off in January, and it was supposed to go for 8 minutes, and it went for about 90 seconds, and the computer shut it down. Apparently had an oxygen valve that was open, stuck open. It wasn't in a proper position. Whatever, they fixed the problem over the last, since January. And they ran a test again last week before the last net we had. And sure enough, it went fine. It went for over 8 minutes. A tremendous amount of smoke. It's really a steam. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. multi sea coming off, which goes up probably a couple thousand feet high, creates some clouds. It's all steam. So green people are very happy about this. It's very good for non-pollutant product. The only problem is the rocket itself is polluting. Into the water. So, unfortunately, it's not reusable. Space launch system, it's very powerful, more powerful than the Saturn V rocket. And eventually, it will take a crew of four to the moon. First mission will be this year, the end of this year. It will be an unmanned mission to the moon. It will launch 13 satellites on the way. Some of them will actually go to the moon or to orbit around. But the vehicle itself would be a crewed vehicle. Exactly, you know, I mean, temperature, humidity, everything would be working as if there was a crew on board. We'll orbit the moon. I don't know how many times, but eventually we'll relight the engine and come back to Earth. The Orion module will separate from the interim stage that we're using. The current stage will burn up in the atmosphere, but the module itself, the Orion itself, will come back to the atmosphere with the heat shield, three big parachutes, and then land in the Pacific Ocean. If that's successful, they work throughout, you know, maybe see if there's no changes that they want to make. They plan on launching a crew the following year. So that mission will go, again, to the moon, around the moon, and then back. And then Artemis 3, they call it Artemis, instead of like the Apollo days, it's Artemis. The third mission is set for actually landing on the moon. We'll see if that happens. There's other components of this whole project that may or may not be fulfilled before that mission starts. Now, one of them would be the Gateway project, which is another space station around the moon. Some people, including me, are calling to have that space station in operation first before they just blindly go back and land on the moon again and come back, similar to what they used to do with Apollo. And long-term plan, whether they do that or not, is to have a Gateway space station up there, which will be consisted of a bunch of modules, power and propulsion and communication module with big solar panels. And then eventually a habitat module. You'll be able to put a crew on there, say up to 40 days or so in the beginning. So you can imagine a crew waiting for another Orion spacecraft to arrive. You know, they'll go up on an Orion spacecraft. They'll dock with it in the space station. And here comes this other Orion spacecraft flying from Earth, launched again on the space launch system, docking with the Gateway system. That would be the crew that will go down to the moon surface to do that. They would have had to have this other landing module or spacecraft attached to the Gateway space station. So that would have had to have been put out there before all this happened. That crew would get into the landing spacecraft and they would deorbit and land on the moon and eventually return. And when they return, they don't go back to Earth directly. They go back to the Gateway space station, and that landing vehicle will, you know, that part of it will be, well, parts of it will, you know, not the descent module, but, you know, the ascent module will probably be reusable in the future.
So we get out, go back into the space station, spend a couple of days with the existing crew that's there, get it back into the Orion spacecraft, and then fly back to Earth. Well, that's the plan right now. We're going to see if this changes over time. Any questions? This is WS2N for the Space Network Report.
N1YDY.
YDY, go ahead.
Build your Orion capsule.
Yeah, that's Boeing doing that. They're a contractor for it. And Boeing and Lockheed are involved with the building of the Orion, space launch system. So, you know, they collaborate on that. They call that the ULA, United Launch Alliance. But Boeing's got the contract for Orion back here.
Isn't Boeing the same company that's having a hard time just providing a capsule up to low Earth orbit in the ISS?
Oh yeah, you're right, 100%. Boeing unfortunately has a lot of problems lately. Hopefully they get back on track. You know, the company had problems with the airplanes. They had the software problem, 737. Of course, you're right with the Starliner project, trying to get to the International Space Station. And they have a flight coming up, this year. That will probably be late summer. Hopefully a little early. But they have a planned unmanned flight to the International Space Station. Two Decembers ago, they tried to do this. They tried to get up to the space station. They didn't make it. Again, they had software problems. And the vehicle, performed good. But software problems threw everything off. The timing wasn't right with between the ground control and the spacecraft itself. The spacecraft saw itself as wanting to be in a different location, so it started firing its thrusters and burning up the fuel. By the time they fixed whatever it was, they were low on fuel and they didn't have enough to make it to the International Space Station. Of course, this is uncrewed. This was their prototype. And eventually came back and successfully landed on ground in White Sands, New Mexico. So now this next one is going to be a do-over. YDY, I forgot your name. I'm sorry. Back to you. This is Paul, WS2N.
Hi, Paul. My name is Hank. Where I'm going, and, I'm quite interested in aviation. I used to work in the field. Boeing's got more than just software problems with the 737 MAX. There was hardware problems and management problems and all the way down to their sales force and the way they actually sold the aircraft. And where I'm going with this is it was a deeply flawed project with deep management issues, not just software issues. And I'm wondering, since they're having such a hard time getting the aircraft capsule, sorry, space capsule up to the ISS, how they're going to successfully be able to put Orion around the moon. Because it just seems to me like it's an invitation to repeat the same set of problems.
Yeah, I know. I that's why I said I hope they straighten out their whatever it is, just the management. It could be. Hope they straighten that out. I don't know, they got this guy, his name is Bruno. He's running the show for Boeing. So, I don't know. He's been doing it for a while. I don't know where, if this is going to work out. I hope they straighten things out. We'll find out on the next Starliner mission if they make it, because right after that they were supposed to send a crew to the space station, a crew of three, eventually a crew of four, but they have astronauts ready to go, and
they can't get their act together, you know, you could have a problem.
And getting a little off topic, the Boeing is one of the two selected companies to go to the ISS. Green Chaser, hearing about it, with the Green Chaser being not selected for crude uses with the ISS. I'm wondering if the people that made that decision at NASA are starting to revisit that. It looks like the Dream Chaser is further along than the Boeing system was.
The SpaceX did. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out what went wrong. And you might be right, management. Back to you.
All right. Nothing more. Just wondering if it really was Boeing building Orion. Thank you very much. N1YDY.
Yeah, it is. And then, you see, and then it's weird. They're involved with partners with Lockheed to build these rockets. They've been building the Delta IV rocket. They built this Delta II that just retired. Two of them are launching the Atlas V on a regular basis. The two of them are building the new Vulcan rocket, which is going to replace the Delta IV and the Atlas V rocket. So, I mean, they got a lot on their plate. I mean, they all do. SpaceX too. But, I mean, Boeing's got a lot on their plate to do all this stuff. Now, Lockheed, it looks like it's not confirmed yet, but they have the contract for the moon lander itself. The habitat part of that lander, the ascent stage, descent stage is given to Blue Origin. You know, everybody's got their hand in the pie here. So, different companies, Blue Origin, Boeing, Lockheed, and then cargo replacements for, to replenish this new space station. That will be in orbit around the moon. Looks like that's being given out to Northrop Grumman with the Cygnus resupply vehicle. That presently goes to the space station on a regular basis. So, okay, any other questions or comments? All right, I know it's getting late, but I want to bring up one minor story, but I think it's interesting. It looks like the Biden administration has picked Bill Nelson to be the new NASA administrator. Bill Nelson, he's been around a long time. He had, three elections as senator for Florida. Didn't make the last election, lost that one, but years ago he was a congressman from Florida, and when the shuttle was being built, you know, they had dreams back then of sending people up, reporters, and of course teachers, and we know what happened to Crystal McCollum with that mission, but before that, early on, it was being supported by Congress, the Senate, and the House. So they said, okay, well, this is becoming commonplace. Let's just, train a couple of, we'll take two volunteers that want to do this, one from Congress and one from the Senate. We'll send them up and see how they do. They could report back on what it's like to go up on this thing that we're spending billions of dollars on these shuttles. So on one flight, they launched Bill Nelson on the space shuttle, and he went up on Columbia. And then I think before him, launched Gone, and then he was gone, about with G. He was Senator from Utah. So they had a congressman from Florida and a senator from Utah. And they went up on different flights. Senator Gone had a lot of problems.